From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Hitesh Hathi, and this is a special edition of Radio Boston. We're wishing you a happy new year and reflecting on 2019 by listening back to our producer's favorite segments. We have sounds from the ocean deep.
What are we hearing there? What is that?
You're hearing the drumming of an Atlantic haddock.
And a conversation with an astronaut in space.
It brings this kind of childhood excitement, you know, just spinning around for a while for no good reason, because without gravity, things are a lot more entertaining.
Plus, performer Jane Lynch celebrates her father's love of the Great American Songbook.
My father always had a song in his heart. He sang all day long around the house, and I do that myself.
And a mother who helped her daughter overcome addiction.
I think the most important thing is to never lose hope, because even when I lost hope, my mom didn't, and I think that's why I'm still here today.
Producers' picks are next on Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Hitesh Hathi. I'm the executive producer of the program. And I'm here at this table with all of Radio Boston's producers. And first, we want to start by saying Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
So let me just introduce everyone in turn. I'm going to start with Paris Alston.
Hello there.
Jamie Bologna.
Hi, Hitesh.
Walter Wuthman.
Hello.
Chris Sitterick.
Howdy, howdy.
Zoe Mitchell.
How's it going?
Hello. So welcome to all of you. And behind the glass over there, we have Tim Skog, our technical producer. He's doing all the recording.
Hey, Tim.
Best in the biz.
Hey, Tim.
Go, Tim.
Really happy to have you here. So this is kind of a special program. You're listening to us. It's a unique hour of Radio Boston. We call it Producers Picks. And does someone want to say what that is?
All of the producers at the table have chosen their favorite segment of the year, and I want to put that word favorite in quotations. We have a lot of favorites, but these are some of the best.
If I remember correctly, you, Zoe, had three favorites last year.
Yeah. This year I have two, so
I trimmed it down
a little bit.
Using that editorial sense.
But don't worry, most of us have kept the favorites down to one, but, you know, we have many favorites. It's true. So we've done this for a couple of years, 3 years now. It's a genuine tradition. So we'll get to our favorites in a minute, but I just want to take a minute for a little reflection. It's been a pretty amazing year in the news. It's been a pretty amazing year for the country. It's been challenging at times. And I just want to take a moment to say that we are so mindful every day that being here, doing what we do, covering the news, bringing it to you, giving it context, those things are a privilege. And even when it's challenging, we are really grateful to be here and grateful for the support that we have back from you. So thank you, listeners. The other thing I want to say that's specific to the program, last year when we did this, I promised you that at some point we would have an announcement, a new host. And we do have a permanent new host for the program, Tiziana Deering. We've sort of edged her out of the studio for this little tradition.
She's getting a vacation.
Yes, but we do love her.
Well, actually, she's working very hard. Just about 20 feet away. But it's been wonderful to have her. She really has joined the spirit and the mission of what we do. And that's something we're grateful for also.
And she's delightful.
Absolutely. Yeah, shout out to Tiziana.
In fact, she's an absolute joy to be around and to work with. And listeners, I want to say to you, thank you also for all the comments, sometimes criticisms, ideas that keep coming from you, and please keep them coming in
the
new
year. Where should they send them? Right to you.
Yes.
Forward them right to Hitesh.
You can, my email is right there on our webpage. So there you are. So let's get to producers' picks. We're going to start with Chris Sitterick.
Sounds great.
What have you got for us?
So personally, I do love when we have comedians in the studio, and we've had some great ones. We had Chris Fleming. We had Pete Holmes. We even had creator of BoJack Horseman, which was great. But the coolest interview that I was a part of this year was absolutely when we talked to Jessica Meir. She was an astronaut. She's from Maine. She was part of the first all-female spacewalk. And we talked to her from here on Earth in Studio 3, while she was hundreds of miles above the planet.
In space!
We arranged it through NASA, and I just have to play a little bit of how the interview started, because you could tell right away this was something special.
Station, this is Houston ACR. Please stand by for a voice check from WBUR.
At one point, while we were talking to her, they were sending us the video, and she just disappeared because it turns out in space you can fly around the spacecraft. She had just disappeared, floated above the camera.
That's so cool.
And then she floated back down.
It's unbelievable. Turns. She's spinning the microphone around, just floating around. And at one point, Tiziana has to stop during the interview and say, Jessica, I have to ask you, it looks like you're just having so much fun. And she had a smile like an 8-year-old at a candy store that was just like, yeah, it's really fun to fly around a spaceship, believe it or not. And she showed us kind of bouncing around off the walls. And it was just, there's nothing like it. It was so cool.
I'm not sure that I've smiled this much for a month consecutively in my life. And I've described it in recent interviews and even in the one that I just had, how it does almost take you back a little bit to your childhood. You know, I personally probably act that way all the time, but you can see it in all of our crewmates where, you know, you'll just be doing your average task and all of a sudden you maybe curl up a little bit, float around, and you just kind of do that because you can. And it brings this kind of childhood excitement, you know, just spinning around for a while for no good reason, because without gravity, things are a lot more entertaining.
You actually have mentioned a couple of times that this was a childhood dream. And according to the Press Herald, you actually wrote in your high school yearbook that your future plan was to go for a spacewalk. Did you really think this was going to happen one day? Have you been sort of single-minded about this from the beginning?
It certainly was my dream the entire way, but I think I also always knew that there was such a small chance of it happening that I didn't think that it necessarily would. And I think that's true for all of us that are fortunate enough to end up in this position. We know that there are so many other people that are equally as qualified, would make great astronauts, but unfortunately, you know, there just aren't enough spots for everybody, and there's a lot of luck involved, so all of us recognize that.
So, Jessica, there's no glass ceiling in space, but you and Christina Cook broke one anyway. Do you ever think about things like that? Do you think about your history and your place in it?
You know, it's not something that I came into this job thinking about. For me, this was always my dream. My previous work led to everything to get me here. And so a lot of it is just doing what we're trained to do. You know, we came into the office and we were treated like everybody else. Christina and I were treated the same as our male colleagues. Interestingly, our class was the first time that we had 50% female and 50% males. So we really already felt equal. We were held to the same standard. We received the same training. So for us going out of the door that day to do that spacewalk, it was really just doing our job, doing what we were trained to do. At the same time, it is not lost on us that it is a special event. It is a historical event. And for me, I think it's just really awe-inspiring to see that it's just becoming a regular event. It just makes sense. We've actually had a continuous female presence on the space station now for quite a while, and that just reflects how far we've come in society. We have more women in all of the STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, math. So it just makes sense that we're starting to see equal representation on all fronts. And I think that's very exciting and hopefully inspiring for everybody that hopes to follow.
So that was Jessica Meir. She's a NASA astronaut. She's a flight engineer on the International Space Station.
So wait, where was that interview done again?
In space! So cool.
That's what I kept thinking all the way through. I mean, she also talks about how she feels like a kid, you know?
Yeah.
All the way through, I kept thinking, and she's in space.
And actually, the interview ended with NASA saying, we now resume normal operational procedures. And that was the sign-off. It was unbelievable.
Chris, thank you so much.
Thanks for giving me
the opportunity. And now we have to tell Elon Musk that we want to make it possible for us to go to space and do the interview.
Yeah, Radio Boston from space. Mm.
I love
that.
Radio Boston
Space Jam 3.
They do have a space force.
Maybe 30, 20, 100 years.
So next up is Walter Wuthman. So, Walt, what have you got for us?
So, I have a segment for you about the ocean, which is one of my absolute favorite topics. I don't know if I've told you guys this. I worked at an aquarium in high school.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, the fish.
You don't share enough.
Yeah, what did you do at the aquarium?
I was a volunteer high school docent. So, I, like, stood behind a touch pool, and I explained the sea stars and the sea cucumbers.
Wow,
and
you
sea
were disseminating information then and now.
Exactly.
I have to tell you, I have a nephew who lives near the San Francisco area where you're from, and his favorite thing is sea stars. He's 2 years old. Sea stars.
They're beautiful, not fish. Some people call them starfish. They're not fish.
Really? They're not fish?
So at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, we were adamant that they were sea stars, not starfish.
This is the first time.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever heard sea stars.
And what's the difference?
A sea star is an invertebrate. A fish is a vertebrate. It has a backbone and bones.
So you always learn things here on Radio
Boston. This is breaking news, right?
Similarly, you should not say jellyfish. We would say jellies.
jellies.
Another invertebrate.
Like the sandals?
Oh, I love it.
Like the sandals, exactly.
So, Walter...
What else is in a fish?
So, who knows how much of this will keep...
I smell a recurring segment. What's not a fish with Walt?
So, Walt, marine biologist.
I love the ocean. I love marine biology. So, when this segment came up, I was really excited to do it. If you think about the ocean, if you were a fish in the ocean, you think about that big blue expanse. But, you know, light doesn't actually travel very far down into the ocean. It disseminates really quickly. So if you're in the ocean, that it's only that thin top layer that's actually lit. Mm. So your eyes are not really the best thing for you to use when you navigate the world. It's your ears. A lot of ocean animals, vertebrates and invertebrates, use sound as their primary way of navigating their way through the world. So incidentally, there's this very cool marine scientist in the area who all she does is study how sound travels through water and how animals use sound to communicate. Her name is Leela Hatch. She's a marine ecologist with the Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary, and we had her on to talk with us about her research. She talked to Tiziana in July. We started by playing some of those cool ocean noises, starting all the way down at the bottom of the food chain.
That's a lobster?
That's a lobster.
How?
Well, they're actually using the hard parts of their body to create that sound. And it's really important. There are invertebrates, again, like the urchin, who are doing that. They're just, you know, feeding along and making the sound. But lobsters are doing this purposefully. It's part of antagonistic behavior among individuals. And we know very much that it's probably used by males to showcase their dominance. Lower frequencies, louder sounds with larger males who are competing for mates.
That's so interesting.
So it's a really, really big part of the show.
All right. So let's take a step up to fish. It sounds like a scene from a horror movie.
It does.
Right?
It does.
Like, creeping down the hall. What are we hearing there? What is that?
You're hearing the drumming of an Atlantic haddock.
Haddock. They drum. Haddock. Wait.
Yeah.
Haddocks drum.
Yep. They're absolutely big part of the band. And when they get together, that is a really loud show. And it's a really big part of showing females their size, of competing against other males and grouping the activity together for reproductive display.
So, like, drumming their tails on something?
No. This is actually part
something
of,
inside of
absolutely.
Them.
This is actually part of their swim bladder and parts of their musculature making that sound rhythmically. And
wow.
They're, you know, timing it, and it has lower frequencies for those larger individuals, all those types of things.
So at the top now, we have the big guys. Let's listen to them there. So who is that big one and why is it making that noise?
That is a North Atlantic right whale.
Okay.
And that's a really iconic sound for Cape Cod Bay and for Massachusetts Bay because that's the sound that both males and females use as a contact call among individuals when they're feeding here. We use that very much to find these animals and to help us understand how many of them are around, where they are. It's a really important part of how we study North Atlantic right whales.
Okay, so these sounds are all important. It's really, this is a rich environment where sound is necessary to life. Something is starting to drown those sounds out. What's happening?
Well, we've been listening for a long time in several places in the ocean where we can really make those measurements and say, okay, over the course of the advance of commercial shipping, for example, in the world's oceans, where we're moving now over 98% of the world's goods on large container ships, that growth has been paralleled by a continuing rise in lower frequency underwater sound. And because of that, the animals that use those same frequencies to communicate have a distant hum in the background all the time, quite chronically.
So we have a sample of that sound of a commercial ship engine. Let's listen to it so we can understand what you're saying. So is that an illustration of the background noise that you're talking about?
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Yeah, that's the sound of the propellers of the vessel, the cavitation. That's a continuous addition to the background sound.
And it's a growing addition, yes?
It's a growing addition, yes.
A lot?
A lot.
Yes. So every decade, we're seeing about a 3 decibel rise.
So given the breadth and scope of the effect of this noise pollution, is there any way to reduce it? What's happening now to try to do that?
There absolutely are. One of the only benefits of this type of study is that with noise, you turn it off and it's gone. Mm-hmm. It's very different than other different kinds of effects that we work with that have a long-term tag. So we have been working with a variety of countries. The U.S. led these efforts through NOAA and the U.S. Coast Guard at the International Maritime Organization at the UN to pass voluntary measures to quiet commercial ships, build them in ways that are quieter. And that effort continues on. We ratified those voluntary requirements, those voluntary measures in 2014, and now Canada continues to promote their adoption.
So do you have hope that there are some good changes coming?
I do. Yeah. I do. I really do see. I see industry increasingly engaged. I see, you know, even in the realm of shipping, a quieter ship is a more fuel-efficient ship. And there are lots of reasons to burn less fuel if you're a ship. And industry knows that. And so I do think that long-term, a greener ship will be a quieter ship.
Wow, Walt. Just the sounds, they were just so amazing.
Walter, what do you think a sea star sounds like?
Well, so here's
the
question.
We should ask your guest. What was her name? Leela Hatch. That was Leela Hatch. She's a marine ecologist with the Stellwagen Bank Marine Sanctuary, and that's managed by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
So, Walt, is everything under the ocean, does everything have a sound?
I think most things have a sound, and a lot of animals use sound as their primary way of seeing the world.
So that episode of SpongeBob, when they did the band underneath the water, that's real?
100%.
Speaking of Boomer, of course, there's a SpongeBob reference, and I kept thinking of The Graduate, where he dives into the swimming pool to escape sound.
The sound of silence.
The sound of silence. Exactly. But the ocean is not silent at all, which everyone knows from just having been in it or a pool.
And that was just a portion of that segment. But if you go to radioboston.org, we'll have links to full segments for everything you hear today if you want to hear more.
Thank you, Walter.
Thank you.
During today's show, we're going out on music from local musicians, starting with Still Gold's Ashes featuring Oompa and Will Daly.
Stay with us. There are many more producers' picks just ahead. I'm Hitesh Hathi. This is Radio Boston. And it burns like the cross does disturb the night as it glows on the black face. The many years of hatred, and wish he to fight. Worth every second of my time to bring the light, and then we might find a space to vibrate and use my words as a weapon to shatter your mind state. Peace. Peace from your ashes. I'll be you, you'll be me. There will be no difference. Let it burn. Get free. The dust, you put water on metal and leave it, then it'll rust. I get it, my we all gotta be tough. That pressure on rusty pipes is surely to make it bust. You human or you human, what kind of colors do you breathe? Welcome back to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Hitesh Hathi, I'm the executive producer of the program, and you're listening to a special hour. We call it Producers Picks. Producers have picked their favorite segments from over the year. I have to say, it's not an easy pick. We have a lot of favorites. Most of us are here because we like our jobs way too much. Around the table with me are Paris Alston.
Hello.
Jamie Bologna.
Happy to be here.
Walter Wuthman.
Hey.
Chris Sitterick.
Still here.
Zoe Mitchell.
Hi.
On the other side of the glass, our technical director, Tim Skog. And so let's move on to the next producer pick. Zoe Mitchell, what have you got for us?
This was a really tough choice for me this year, like all years, and I toyed around with a few different options for this. One of the episodes that was particularly meaningful to me this past year was the full hour we did marking 50 years since Chappaquiddick. That was the incident when then-Senator Ted Kennedy drove his car off a bridge in Chappaquiddick, and his passenger, Mary Jo Kopechne, died. She was just 28 years old. And if you guys recall, we were determined to track down people who had been there that day in one way or another.
And it's worth remembering, I think, for all of us, this was a very difficult segment to do. It's a very difficult story. There's a real tragedy at the heart of it. And that was a riveting interview, and it reminded us how close we still are to that event 50 years ago, how many unresolved feelings there are for people here who are directly connected and for us as a community. It was a very powerful hour to remember what happened to Mary Jo Kopechne.
Yeah, and so that's what made, I think, it so important for us 50 years later to really hopefully find people who were impacted in a real way by this.
And who could paint a picture for us.
Yeah, and who could help us relive and remember what it was really like. But I was so grateful because I ended up getting in touch with Bob Bruguer, who was one of the first officers to respond at the scene when the accident was called in. And it just led to an incredible interview with him about how he remembers it today. And you can just hear in what he says how it still kind of haunts him, what happened there.
50 years later. That's so crazy.
50 years later. So that's when I thought about choosing, and I guess I kind of chose. I was one of my two. I'll admit it. But we'll have a link to that at radioboston.org. But because it's producer's picks, for this program, I wanted to play something that had a little bit more joy to it as we go into a new year and, you know, a new beginning. So over the summer, I got to interview Jane Lynch.
Yeah. Like the Jane Lynch.
She's a comedian, singer, and an Emmy Award winner.
We know who she is.
Yeah, you guys know, yeah. She portrayed Sue Sylvester on Glee, who was that ruthless cheerleading coach back when I was in middle school. So I have a connection to her through that program.
I think I was in middle school then, too. My second one.
Yeah. Your son was in middle school.
I was going to say, he was there. It was for a parent-teacher conference. Yeah,
parent-teacher conference. This is getting cruel. Okay.
She's also a self-taught singer, which is what we talked about. I met up with her at Boston Symphony Hall. She was in town to sing with the Boston Pops, doing this cabaret show of sorts. And it was all of these songs that she loves from the Great American Songbook. And she's super funny, and her performance with the Boston Pops was kind of had this sense of humor to it. So I was expecting the interview to be, you know, fun and funny. But I appreciate this one because she also was very sincere and spoke from the heart about her relationship with her parents and how big of a role they played in getting her where she is and putting together this performance. So I just wanted to play this one because I think it's another instance where you go into the interview expecting one thing and you come out with something kind of different than what you initially expected.
Well, I am the daughter of Frank Lynch, Frank and Eileen Lynch, and we are a singing family. And my parents loved to sing, and they loved to harmonize. And I grew up with music. My father always had a song in his heart, on his lips, and he sang all day long around the house, and I do that myself. Anybody who spends 5 minutes with me would know that that's who I am. I've always loved doing performing, and it's only in the last 6 or 7 years that I've been doing it like on a touring basis.
Can you tell me, and obviously we don't want to reveal every single song in the show, but are there any that have a particular significance to you that you're performing tonight or any reason you chose any of these?
I open with Lazy, Hazy, Crazy Days of Summer, which was a Nat King Cole hit in 1963, and it may be perhaps my first musical memory. It was a favorite song of my father's, and we loved summer growing up. Like in the 60s, summer was all about going on vacation with the family, loading up the station wagon and singing and, you know, going to the beach. And that's a song that celebrates that very American thing that I don't know that folks do anymore. Maybe they do. I don't know, but I just love that about the summer.
Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. Those days of sodas and pretzels and beer. Roll out.
And also the Boo Hoo, which is a song that I don't even know that my parents knew I was aware of.
Boo-hoo, that's why I'm crying for you. One day you'll feel like I do, and you'll be boo-hoo-hooing too.
I listened to it on a 78 in my grandmother's, on her old Victrola record player. And I would play it over and over again. I thought it was a wonderful song when I was a kid. And I also did this song called A Letter from Camp. It's an Alan Sherman song, and it's really hilarious. And it's Hello Mutta, Hello Fada, Here I Am at Camp Granada. And I remember loving that song when I was growing up.
What did you love about it?
Yeah, it rhymed, and it was funny, and it was about a kid who was at camp who just wanted to go home. He hated it, he hated it. Darling Fada, lovely Mutta, how's my precious little brother? Let me come home if you miss me. I will even let Aunt Bertha hug and kiss me.
You know, one thing I wanted to ask you about, I also am a fan of a lot of these songs. I'm a big mm-hmm. musical person, Pence, Glee, etc. What do you think it is about these American songs that make them so kind of timeless? Like, they never feel like they go out of style. They always feel new.
Yeah, they're musically very simple. And they're melody driven, and they're written to a basic formula, and they're very satisfying. I'm going to sound like an old lady now. Kids these days. But there's kind of a satisfying simplicity with a well-formed pop song that follows a particular recipe. There's beautiful rhymes, and the lyrics in some of the songs I'm singing are like poetry. That's what I love about it, and that's why I think these songs will endure.
I'd love to ask you, you mentioned your connection to this music started with your family, mm-hmm. and I was reading some of the songs tonight are definitely a tribute to your father. You mentioned mm-hmm. Hazy Crazy Days of Summer. Mm-hmm. You know, what do you think it would mean to him that you're doing this here?
Oh, I was just saying that out there. It's just he would be thrilled to death. He would die all over again. he would just love this show. And I say in the beginning, this is basically a show inspired by my father. I found that the music that was first and foremost in my mind when I thought of what would I like to perform, it was all the stuff my dad used to sing around the house. And he would just love it. My mother, who is also not with us anymore, would love it too. I'm from a family of they came together on music, my mom and dad. They're not professional, but they would sing in the bars in Chicago. They met in a bar on the south side of Chicago, and they knew all the pop songs, and they harmonized. My dad had a beautiful tenor. And I remember my mother, toward the end of her life, she had a carotid artery, and they nicked her vocal cord, and she couldn't sing anymore. And that depressed her more than anything. And I was always so sad for her, 'cause she loved to sing in church, and now she had to switch octaves all the time, and it upset her greatly not to be able to sing.
That's my interview with Jane Lynch. And once again, you know, I feel like I loved speaking with her because of just how much heart and connection there really was to her family, and how she kind of turns that into a comedic, lively, really fun performance that she did with the Boston Pops this summer.
You know, and as we were editing it, to echo what you're saying, what I kept thinking is this is one of those places where someone's public persona and the actual person are so different. Mm. We had a sense of yeah. who she was, you know, from her other work as a performer. But as you point out, the sincerity with which she, you know, does this music and her feeling for it. And obviously, as we just heard her talking about her mother, the connection she has with her parents and especially her mother through it is very powerful. And that's producer Zoe Mitchell. Zoe, thank you so much for bringing that to us.
Thank you.
So next up is Paris Alston. Paris, what do you have for us?
So I have two, believe it or not.
Oh, no. I'm not the trend, Zoe. It's a trend. Is this sneaking
another
in of
producer
two like a trend here?
Well, they're two.
We'll need a second hour.
Yeah.
Oh, exactly. Yes, so I do have two, as a matter of fact, but they are short and they're thematic, which is always great.
Yes.
It always helps everyone enjoy them. And Zoe talked a bit about family, and mine are both related to family as well. And as you all know, family was a big part of my 2019. It's a big part of all of my 25 years, and I'm sure it's a big part of your lives too. And you all are my Radio Boston family, so
aww.
That's always great.
Thanks, Paris.
You're welcome. All that said, I wanted to point out two powerful moments from our show this year that were focused on family, and they both hit close to home for me as well. So the first came almost a year ago, if you can put yourself back into last January, when we set aside a special hour to talk about the opioid epidemic. And this hour was hosted by WBUR's Deborah Becker, who does extensive reporting on the opioid epidemic. It's a really sobering topic, of course, but we took a really intimate lens into it, which I really appreciated. And during this hour, we spoke to Michael Wilson, who's the director of family services for Bay State Recovery Services and author of Loving Lions. We also spoke to Maureen Cavanaugh, who is the founder of Magnolia New Beginnings and author of If You Love Me, which is a book that tells the story of her daughter's addiction and how she helped her daughter through that.
And this is, I have to say, one of those moments when we realize what an amazing responsibility we have and the trust we have when someone like Maureen Cavanaugh comes on this program and is willing to talk so openly about some of the most painful stuff anyone could imagine. I mean, you'll hear the story in a minute. Why don't you set it up, Paris?
Yeah, most definitely. So an important thing to point out about this is that we open the phone lines the entire hour, and we wanted people to call in with their own personal stories about addiction, about how it has affected either themselves or loved ones in their lives, which is what Maureen's story was all about. And at one point during the hour, she was talking about the role of family in helping a loved one overcome addiction. And then this happened.
I want to take another call here. Caitlin is on line one.
Hi.
Hi, Katie. You're on the air.
Hi, Mom.
Oh, my goodness.
We didn't know she was calling.
I've been trying to call for like an hour.
Yeah, I know. Our lines are jammed, Katie.
Oh,
so what do you want to... Your mom has told your story so beautifully in her book. Your mom has created this support group for families around the country, really, to help families. Katie, what's your message to our listeners who are calling here and they're saying, you know, the system is kind of broken, but we're doing the best we can, and here you are, a success story. What do you tell us, Katie, to inspire us?
I think the most important thing is to never lose hope, because even when I lost hope, my mom didn't, and I think that's why I'm still here today. So, you know, be supportive, don't enable. I always tell her, thank you for not enabling me, but supporting me at the same time and never giving up on me.
Well, I don't think there's a dry eye in this studio, Katie, so I appreciate it. And, it must have been hard, though, not to be able to live at home and live with your family. I mean, I think that must have been a difficult thing. Was it? You wouldn't have said this 2-3 years ago, that thank you, Mom, for not letting me stay home, I bet.
No, I used to ask her to leave me alone. I'm like, why won't you just leave me alone? And she would say, well, that's not going to happen, so thank you.
Well,
I'm very grateful today that she didn't leave me alone.
And what was it? What was it, do you think, Katie, that made you say, I can't do this anymore, I need to make a change?
Like towards the end, I just kept overdosing and overdosing, like I think 4 in 1 week, and just way more than that. But I think eventually, like, I realized that, like, God didn't want me to die, and I had to keep going, like, learning the hard way, and I just, like, finally just stood up and had enough.
Well, good
God.
For you. And 20 months, I understand, and things are going well.
Yep. Things are going really
awesome.
Well.
All right. Mm.
You know, we just got lucky, too. Any of those times she could have passed away. Right. And that, I think, is the huge difference between her and maybe somebody else, because I think given enough time and support, everybody would get well. It's just, unfortunately, some people run out of luck.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think we all need to take a little breath after that.
Wow.
I mean, talk about a powerful radio moment. That's just a one-of-a-kind moment that you don't always get, and you have to really cherish it when you get it. And it was a complete surprise, too. And like Deb said, every eye in the studio was watery.
And it's also one of those moments when I think we realize what an extraordinary responsibility we have, right? I mean, there are these two people who are willing to trust us so completely. And we just had no idea the daughter was going to call.
Yeah, it was a treat. And it was, you know, like I said, we were talking about a really sobering topic, but it was a real treat to hear from someone who had overcome addiction and who had the help of her mother through every step of it.
Paris, you also have another one for us.
This one was just towards the end of 2019, and it was when we sat down with Mindy Freed and Laurie Sheridan to talk about the Shape of Care podcast, which is a podcast that Mindy hosts. And this conversation was done with Tiziana, who had a personal connection because of the caregiving that her family had done for her mother. And Laurie was featured as a guest on this podcast to talk about caring for her husband, Ira, who has Parkinson's disease. And Laurie was honest with us. The job of caregiving is one of the hardest she's ever done. I think anyone who has cared for a loved one who is sick or ill or aging knows that it is a really challenging job. But she and Mindy sat down to talk with us about that and about how you can find support in that role.
I run out of patience. I become frustrated. I become angry with Ira. Sometimes I don't know who he is or whom I'm dealing with. He's like a different person. And what's helped me is really two things. I mean, one, I've learned to be more patient. I've learned a lot from other caregivers, both paid and unpaid family caregivers, some of the skills in dealing with that. But what's helped me the most is being in a weekly support group of care partners.
How did you find it?
I found it through the hospital where he's seen for his Parkinson's disease, and that has the advantage that everyone in the group is caring for someone with the same disease, but that's not really essential because I've also had friends at work who were dealing with similar but not the same thing, and we've formed our own little support group just talking, you know, around the edges and at coffee and lunch about how we got through life. And I've learned a lot from all kinds of support groups about tips for how to get through the day and how to keep myself relatively intact,
Mindy,
because if I fall apart.
Mindy, is there, Laurie, I didn't mean to cut you off. I apologize for that. Is there any way to be prepared? I mean, so many times an illness comes on quickly or unexpectedly. Were you prepared for your responsibilities, and how can one, without being macabre, prepare oneself?
Right.
Seems like most people at some stage in their lives are going to have these kinds of responsibilities one way or another.
Right. I mean, I think I've found that a lot of people are not ready quite yet to bring in support or to, you know, they see that somebody that they love needs help. And that's kind of rebuffed initially. Sometimes, you know, the person who's in the position of being the caregiver sees what's coming down the pike. And what I always say is that it's really important to do your research on your end and have as much information as you can have so that when things get a little worse, perhaps it's a crisis or it's just a little red flag that there needs to be an intervention, that you're ready with bringing somebody in or having your loved one assessed, evaluated to see what kinds of support they need. So I think that that upfront time, it's both helpful to the person who is going to be a caregiver, but it's also ultimately helpful down the line to the person who needs caring for.
So again, another powerful moment, and I wanted to pull at all of your heartstrings.
Yeah, a little bit.
So I hope that I did.
No, Paris, you know what's really interesting about both of those, though? Those are both really heavy, serious, emotional topics. And as you said, we opened the phones, and phones were jammed for both of those shows. And I think it just shows how meaningful it is to have a place for people to come and talk about these things in a real, deep, rich way.
Yeah, most definitely. And particularly with caregiving, I mean, my mother took on an enormous caregiving role this year with a couple of our family members, and she always just wanted a place where she could do that, people she could talk to, people she could share that experience with and find support. And I want to also say what I loved about those is that even though they were topics that we really had to think deeply about and that were very emotional, our guests really were kind of lighthearted about that. I mean, you heard Maureen and Katie, and they were having this conversation where they were able to smile and be happy that they had arrived at that moment. Same with Laurie and Mindy. And it just goes to show how family can really bring out the best of a situation, even when it's really tough.
Triumph of the human spirit.
And the importance of keeping your joy throughout everything as much as you can. Paris Alston, producer extraordinaire, thank you so much.
Thank you, Hitesh. And all today, we're going out on music from a few local musicians who we've had on the show. Right now, you're hearing Dreon's song, A Change Is Coming.
Where is the mother doing all she can?
Stay with us. One more producer pick up ahead. I'm Hitesh Hathi. This is Radio Boston.
Legacy, I can see how you're feeling now. All hope has gone and bowed down, but the race is given to him who endures. So keep holding on, keep pressing on, until you see a change complete. Just keep running.
Welcome back to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Hitesh Hathi, and around the table with me are all of Radio Boston's producers. Actually, let me start on the other side of the glass, metaphorically around the table. Tim Skog, our technical director. Paris Alston.
Hello.
Jamie Bologna.
How you doing?
Walter Wuthman.
Hey, Hitesh.
Chris Sitterick.
Howdy.
Zoe Mitchell.
Hello.
And next up, Jamie Bologna.
All right, get
Jamie, ready. What have you got?
So I'm bringing you guys a bit of an interview that we did with Tan France, one of the five hosts of Netflix's Queer Eye. He was in town. He had a new memoir out. And I'm sorry, Hitesh, I kind of put you through the ringer on that.
Yeah.
I was like, Walt, you told me that Tan France was coming. And I marched over to Hitesh's desk. And I was like, I don't care what day of the week it is. I want to do that interview. And you obliged. So thank you.
And I want everyone
who had a choice.
I want everyone who's listening to know that I had no idea who Tan France was. But I was just going to say
helped,
yes.
Actually.
Yeah. And you were one of very few, because when you did this interview outside the studio, there was a fan club.
I've been working on this show since 2013, yes. And I have
never
seen that many WBUR employees crowding around the studio
and that
to
includes
see a famous person,
presidential candidates,
or the
senators,
governor, you name it. Like, a lot of people come through WBUR, and I just never seen it like that. It was
Though, personally,
packed.
I prefer to think of it as everyone scoping out my style.
Yes,
fashion-wise.
Well, so he's the fashionista of the show, and we did a lot of that. We talked about fashion, and we took calls. But I do want to play my favorite part of the interview, which was when we arguably got to one of the central themes of Queer Eye, which was this idea of overcoming differences. And so we talked with Tan France about whether he finds it difficult to connect with people on the show who are just so different from him.
I am a South Asian man. I was in England. I now live in the US, so now I'm an immigrant. Believe me, I've had a lifetime of training when it comes to people being somewhat negative towards me. And so I know how to combat that. I know how to approach that. I lead with kindness and tolerance and accept any question, no matter how disrespectful they may seem. I will accept those questions and answer them. I was trained my whole life for this.
Well, and you actually write about that in the book very beautifully, about some of the incredibly racist way that people have treated you growing up and now, and the slurs and harassment, and especially after 9/11, the fact that you are routinely pulled aside in the airport for questioning. How have you come to terms with all of that, or have you?
I have. Again, it's all I've ever known. If that was all you ever knew, you'd find a way to reconcile. And so what I do is I understand how it makes me feel, and I know that I don't want anyone else to feel that way. So I speak out about it, and I will against it, and I will speak to the people who are throwing those assaults at me, that abuse at me, and ask them why they feel it's okay, what they think that I've done that would warrant such a reaction. The most common thing used to be, we pay for you to live. Like, my taxes pay for you. My reaction was always...
What does that even mean?
Well, because I was in their country, air quotes, you're here as an immigrant, and so therefore you must be taking advantage of our system. No, I had a job. My parents were in that country. They had many jobs to make sure that we were providing...
Well, and you say in the book very strongly, this is my country.
This is my country. I was born and raised in that country, and so when people are throwing that abuse at me, I very calmly give a rebuttal.
Tan, I also want to ask you about another thing you wrote in the book, it's in a couple of places, but early on you say you don't want to be asked by interviewers about religion, and that it's a very personal thing for you, but then later on you write about how important your representation is on TV, and that you, quote, hope that there comes a time when there is no need to talk about being queer or gay or Muslim. And so I guess my question, I was thinking this while reading, if we're not in that place where there's no need to talk about it, then why not talk about it?
There's no reason to speak out more about it other than to just be. When you are a white man, I can't imagine that in any interview they'd say, hey, so you're white, tell me about how that feels. There's no, you just are, you represent by just being. And that's how I feel about who I am at this point. I don't talk about the ins and outs of being gay anymore, really, other than I'm gay. I'm brown.
It just is.
It just is. That is just so.
But you also write in the book about growing up, you know, yearned to see people like you reflected on television.
Yeah.
And now you're that person, perhaps for thousands or millions of people around the world. I mean, is that a heavy responsibility?
It really is. But the way I do it now in particular is just by being on the show. I don't talk about religion. On the show, I don't talk about my upbringing. I just am there. I am doing the same job as everybody else. And I love that it's just normalizing who we are, what we do. We are just the same as everybody else. I'm on a show that's a makeover show, that's a make better show, that was helping human connection. And so I don't belabor any of those points. It comes up in conversation because it's an important part of me, but that's not the only part of me. My sexuality, my religion, they're all secondary. First and foremost, I am a person, and I'm equal to my peers on the show. And so that's how I feel about my responsibility. Yes, I feel a responsibility to represent my community well, and therefore I try and make sure that I'm being the best version of myself that I can be, and that is how I'd represent.
So I want to ask you about another thing I noticed in the book, and I'm sorry if I might push your buttons here.
Go.
But, okay, so there are multiple places in the memoir where you write about folks who hurt you, who wronged you, who were mean to you when you were a kid, or said mean things to you in your DMs, and each time you kind of have a strong reaction back at them, you know, deleting their Facebook requests, and I will never, you know, basically calling them out.
Yeah.
And so I guess I'm wondering why it was important for you to include those anecdotes in your memoir.
Because
are you still hurting? Do you want to talk it out?
No, I don't, I'm not still hurting. The reason why I included that is because I want people to see that I am still very much a person. If I went on the show, if you went on the show and you had people from your old life who were wanting to be part of your life because you had just, let's say, for example, you won the lottery. They wanted to be a part of your life because
Dream about it every day.
Lovely, right?
Yeah.
They wanted to be a part of your life. Would you really respond well to that? No, you'd be like, no, the reason why you want to now date me is because I just won the lottery. So I wanted this book to be very clear. I am still very much Tan. And therefore, if somebody is ludicrous and they are crazy enough to send me a message to say, hey, we should hang out more, when they haven't contacted me in 15 years, I need them to know I'm still Tan. Very much Tan.
And you still hurt me then.
Yes.
So Tan France, one of the five co-hosts of Netflix's Queer Eye there, still very much Tan France, whether he's famous or not famous. But I think one of the things, Hitesh, that I liked about that part of the interview was, you know, we get into religion and being queer and being an immigrant. But it was also part of this sort of loose, fun, conversational call-in with people asking fashion questions. And so I think... For me, this segment highlights what I love so much about this show is that we kind of get to the true art of living, and we allow people to come to the table and discuss both important issues and also fun things like fashion.
And there, part of it was the hurt and the injury that he had felt as a child, as a young adult, because of racism, homophobia. He's still carrying that.
Yep.
And Jamie, you did that interview, and I thought it was beautiful. The way you were able to, he sensed a certain kind of sincerity, and he reacted to it and said things that I wasn't expecting him to say, in between telling me that I should tuck or untuck my shirt.
See, you can be serious and have a good time.
I want to say he talked about winning the lottery. I just want to end this hour by saying I feel every day like I've won the lottery when I walk in, especially with all of you here. As Paris said, we are a family, and really, it is like winning the lottery.
Just don't try to cash the check.
Yeah, it doesn't come with $1 million. No, it's
but
true.
But if you get $1 million, you'll split it with us.
Oh, sure.
It is now on the record.
Is this on tape? Is this on tape? That concludes this special hour of Radio Boston, a look back at the last year with some of our favorite segments. I want to say once again to everyone listening, we wish you a happy new year. We are so grateful to be able to share this coming year with you. Let me just say thank you also to all the producers here. Paris Alston.
Thank you.
Jamie Bologna.
Thanks, Hitesh.
Walter Wathman.
Thank you.
Chris Sitterick.
May the force be with you, Hitesh.
Zoe Mitchell.
Thank you and happy new year.
And on the other side, we have Tim Skoog, Technical Director Extraordinaire. stay tuned for more Radio Boston in this new year.
I love the winter weather, so the two of us can get together. There's nothing sweeter, finer. When it's nice and cold, I can hold my baby closer to me and collect them fine kisses that are due me. I love the winter weather.